From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now!
The verdict reminds us that protection against terrorism should never outweigh the protection of our own civil rights. Otherwise, like my sister Judy Berry, we'll be made to suffer the consequences.
Renowned environmentalist Judy Berry and Daryl Cherney win a multi-million dollar verdict in civil rights lawsuit against the FBI. Then the latest U.S., quote, terrorist suspect, Abdullah al-Muhajir, is designated an enemy combatant and held without charges in a legal twilight zone. His attorney files a motion challenging his indefinite military detention at a high-security naval brig in South Carolina. And as the Bush administration once again turns national debate to the question of homeland security, we'll look at how the man that ran his election campaign as the education president seems to be abandoning one of the most basic ways of ensuring a safe and secure country, an educated population. We'll talk about standardized tests, school budgets, and a debate on privatizing education. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, the lawyer for a U.S. citizen accused of plotting a radioactive dirty bomb attack in the United States, filed a motion in federal court Tuesday challenging the constitutionality of his indefinite military detention. Attorney Donna Newman says the Pentagon has not yet told her whether she will be allowed to see her client, Abdullah al-Muhajir. He was arrested last month, but was transferred Sunday from a federal prison in Lower Manhattan to a high-security naval brig in South Carolina. According to the Washington Post, that transfer came less than 2 days before he was scheduled to appear before a civilian judge. No charges have been filed against him. And London Independent is reporting British and European security officials are highly skeptical of the Bush administration's case. British sources point out no evidence has been produced to show that al-Muhajir had access to the radioactive material needed to build a bomb, or indeed that he'd even worked out a time or place to launch an attack. In Washington, there's growing suspicion that the arrest was seized on by the Bush administration in dramatic fashion for political ends. Families of victims of the September 11th attacks rallied on Capitol Hill Tuesday to call for an independent investigation into why intelligence agencies failed to prevent the airliner attacks that killed more than 3,000 people. Speaker after speaker described their cause as non-political and a matter of grave national concern. Ellen Mariani lost her husband in the United Airlines flight that smashed into the South Tower of the World Trade Center. She wore a shirt emblazoned with the American flag, pendants, and a picture of her husband. She said, "I want a real investigation. I don't want lip service. I'm angry, and I'm not going away." The Washington Post is reporting a former Boston cab driver, once identified by authorities as a major terrorism suspect, was kept in solitary confinement for more than 8 months without seeing a judge or being assigned a lawyer. Authorities transferred Nabil Amarab last week from the Metropolitan Detention Center in Brooklyn to a Buffalo courtroom where he was arraigned on charges stemming from an attempt to illegally enter the country last June. If he pleads guilty, he faces a sentence shorter than the term he's already spent in jail. The Washington Post is reporting the Pentagon's taking steps to shield the National Missile Defense Program from the public, Congress, and even traditional oversight measures within the Pentagon as it boosts spending and intensifies development of the project. In recent months, defense officials have exempted missile defense projects from the planning and reporting requirements normally applied to major acquisition programs. They've stopped providing Congress with detailed cost estimates and timetables for anti-missile systems, and they've announced plans to restrict information about targets and decoys used in flight tests. The increasing secrecy comes as the 30-year-old anti-ballistic missile treaty is set to expire Thursday, 6 months after President Bush invoked a provision allowing either side to withdraw upon such notice. The treaty's long been hailed as the centerpiece of nuclear stability. The Pentagon will mark the treaty's death with a ceremony on Saturday in Alaska, breaking ground on a test site for the administration's $64 billion Star Wars system. The ABM treaty had banned such construction. A spokesperson for Afghanistan's interim leader, Hamid Karzai, says Karzai made a mistake in claiming the presidency at the traditional Loya Jirga assembly before a vote had been called. The incident came after Karzai's main opponent, former King Mohammad Zahir Shah, announced under U.S. pressure he will withdraw his candidacy. Karzai then told Reuters news agency, "It's finished. The assembly has voted for me." Women's Affairs Minister Seema Samar said, "This is not a democracy. This is a rubber stamp. Everything has already been decided by the powerful ones." With the United States leading the way, the World Food Summit has formally declared its commitment to studying and facilitating the use of biotechnology as a way to address hunger. The declaration came after U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Ann Veneman told the summit the U.S. Agency for International Development is launching a 10-year, $100 million collaborative agriculture biotechnology initiative to advance research on crop varieties better suited to growing conditions in developing countries. She also announced the U.S. will hold a ministerial-level conference next year to focus on the needs of developing countries in adopting new food and agriculture technologies. The declaration is sharply at odds with the goals of developing countries. Their leaders are urging the U.S. and Europe to remove farm subsidies and open their markets. The Ugandan president, Yoweri Museveni, said protectionism is the enemy of the hungry, not lack of improved seeds. And representatives of hundreds of NGOs in a parallel meeting in Rome were stunned. President of the NGO Forum, Sergio Morelli, told IPS, "It is incomprehensible. It shows the influence of nations led by the United States upholding the interests of multinationals involved in biotechnology." And finally, two more bishops resigned Tuesday as a result of charges of sexual misconduct. In New York, Auxiliary Bishop James McCarthy resigned after admitting to having had a number of affairs with women over several years. In Lexington, Kentucky, Bishop J. Kendrick Williams resigned after being accused of molesting three boys. The resignations come as U.S. Roman Catholic bishops prepare for a meeting in Dallas this week to adopt a national policy on sexual abuse of minors.
What they found was 111 common household items, which they carefully bagged and tagged and wrote in the newspapers that they had found materials in our houses that could have been used to make the bomb. Those materials included a red magic marker, duct tape, Elmer's glue, and of course, many, many nails. In fact, they took took finishing nails out of my window trim to try to find a matching nail to the ones that didn't match the ones in the bomb. But all of this was done with great fanfare in the press and headlines day after day. Nails match, bomb materials match, only suspects, and those kind of things. But the other thing that really kind of put them in a bind as far as this lie that we were the bombers was the bomb itself. The material that they found, not only that it didn't prove that we were the bombers, but it certainly went the other way and showed us clearly to have been victims of an assassination attempt. The first thing, as I already showed you, was that this bomb was hidden completely under my car seat. Another problem with the bomb was that it was an anti-personnel device. They were trying to say that we were transporting it to use in some kind of act of ecotage against some power line somewhere. But this was an anti-personnel bomb. It was wrapped with nails for shrapnel effect.
The late Judy Berry, from the CD Who Bombed Judy Berry, Too Clever to Catch was the cut. It was mixed with Midnight Feast by Mr. Scruff here on Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. We listen to the late Judy Berry's words as a federal jury Tuesday handed Earth First activists Judy Berry and Daryl Cherney a stunning victory in this civil rights lawsuit against the FBI and the Oakland police. The jurors found six of the seven defendants guilty of violating Berry and Cherney's civil rights, first by arresting them, then by conducting searches of their homes and a smear campaign in the press. The jury awarded the pair a total of $4.4 million in damages. Tuesday's victory comes more than 12 years after a motion-triggered pipe bomb exploded in Judy's car while the two were driving in Oakland. They were organizing a major Redwood summer action that would have brought thousands of activists to California to protest destructive logging practices. The bomb nearly killed Judy. It fractured her pelvis, crushed her tailbone, leaving her crippled and in constant pain. Berry and Cherney had both received death threats from the timber industry supporters in the months before the bombing and reported them to local police. But the FBI and Oakland police did not pursue any of these leads. Instead, they quickly arrested Judy and Daryl, saying the pair were victims of their own misfired bomb. They claimed they had physical evidence linking Judy to the making of the bomb. When the time came to press charges, the district attorney declined, citing a lack of evidence. The Oakland police promptly closed their investigation, their so-called investigation. But the FBI continued theirs, telling the media that Judy and Daryl were the only suspects. Barry and Cherney filed a federal civil rights lawsuit against the FBI and the Oakland Police in 1991, a year after the bombing. They accused the two of violating their civil rights in an attempt to discredit Earth First and its political message. The case finally went to court in April of this year, but Judy Barry had died of breast cancer in March of 1997. Well, today we're joined on the phone by Daryl Cherney. We tried to reach the FBI for comment. The agency's not speaking to the press, referring calls to the Justice Department, which litigated the case on the FBI's behalf. The Justice Department refused to come on the air, but said, quote, they're reviewing the opinion and considering their next step. Daryl Cherney, welcome to Democracy Now!
Good to be here, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. Your reaction to the verdict?
Incredible relief and a sense of vindication. 11 years of litigation is more than anybody should go through, and I am so happy it's over.
Can you talk about, after 17 days of deliberations, what the jury found and who the people were that you sued?
Well, we originally sued quite a few FBI agents, but the judge dismissed many of them, including the upper brass, which was of great distress to us. But we wound up suing four FBI agents and three Oakland police officers. And what the jury got to see was essentially lie after lie being told by both FBI and Oakland police officials. FBI and Oakland police saying that nails strapped to the bomb matched nails in the back of Judy's in a bag in the back of Judy's car, nails which were completely dissimilar. Oakland police said a small piece of pipe found in my van matched a huge piece of pipe that was used to blow Judy up, and saying that these two dissimilar pieces of pipe were identical. We saw expert witnesses by the FBI. They brought a bomb expert whose only expertise in bombing in a court case was the blowing up of an anthill by some teenagers. And used him as an expert on the car bomb case. We saw just pathetic testimony by law enforcement over and over again. The jury got to see this. What I said was it was the good news was the lies told by the FBI were so transparent that the jury could easily see it, and the bad news was that these were the guys running the country.
I wanted to go for a minute to Martha Barry, who is the younger sister of Judy Barry. We reached her right before the program, and she recorded this statement for the family.
Hello, my name is Martha Barry. My sister Judy Barry died of breast cancer in 1997. I'd like to say a few words on behalf of my family. My family is grateful to the jury and wants to thank them for their courageous decision. They have affirmed our faith in the justice system. We're only sorry that my sister Judy is no longer alive and able to share this sweet moment. Before and after my sister's bombing in 1990, law enforcement that we normally turn to for protection was not there for her. When the call went out over a Fort Bragg radio station to kill Judy Barry, no one stepped in to defuse the situation. When she received even more death threats, the local police cold-heartedly dismissed her pleas for help. And after she was viciously bombed, the system failed her again. When her family and friends came to her side at the Oakland Hospital, they found her critically hurt and in horrific, obscene pain. Yet Judy was also in a state of panic. Not only could she receive no police protection from the anonymous bomber, who was still at large, but the Oakland police wanted to pull her from her room and place her in handcuffs in the hospital's prison ward for supposedly bombing herself. She suffered further indignities when she heard herself characterized as an eco-terrorist bomber by the news media, and when her house was publicly searched by the FBI as she lay helplessly in her hospital bed. Thereafter, she lived in constant pain and anxiety, and spent the rest of her life trying to clear her name. The ripple effect of a violent crime is enormous. When the authorities are against you rather than on your side, all the problems are magnified. Judy suffered, her two young children suffered, her family suffered, and her wider community of friends and supporters suffered. Now that the Oakland police and the FBI have been brought to justice, they owe it to my family to explain what cause they had to hold my sister's civil rights in such contempt. Judy's political message was adamantly nonviolent, yet for 12 long years, she has been wrongly connected with terrorism. After September 11th and the threatening of many of our rights in the name of homeland security, I'm afraid that this scenario will occur more often. My family has seen up close how much harm can result when rights are ignored. In Judy's case, the authorities stepped outside the law, and yesterday they were found guilty of false arrest, defamation of character, and illegal search and seizure. The verdict reminds us that protection against terrorism should never outweigh the protection of our own civil rights. Otherwise, like my sister Judy Berry, we'll be made to suffer the consequences.
And that was Martha Berry, the younger sister of the late Judy Berry, responding to this precedent-setting verdict yesterday in a California courtroom. The federal lawsuit, a federal jury handed Earth First activists Judy Berry and Daryl Cherney a stunning victory in their suit against the FBI and the Oakland police. On the line with us also, Daryl Cherney. Now, the jury was hung on whether you, Daryl, were falsely arrested. It cleared the police and FBI of conspiracy, but affirmed your contention that the FBI and Oakland police had violated your civil rights and First Amendment rights by defaming you, casting a pall over your plans to protest against logging called Redwood Summer. What about this issue of conspiracy? Why didn't you win on those charges?
Well, first of all, the judge issued a gag order on the jury, and so for the time being, we're not going to know what the jury was thinking. I believe some members of the media are filing a First Amendment lawsuit to be able to talk to the jury. But using speculation for just a moment, we were not allowed to bring in FBI past behavior, the COINTELPRO program that was in place for, you know, many years to discredit activist group. The FBI's long history that dates back to their founding right after the turn of the century, designed to attack labor unions and later, you know, be the fuel that generated the Red Scare, going after Hollywood entertainers and more union activists, the civil rights movement, and so forth down the line. They were not able to see that the FBI operated as a political police force because we were not allowed to bring that in as evidence. So without that context, the notion of conspiracy may have seemed a bit foreign to the jury. Why would they think that any law enforcement agency was set up as a political police force unless we were allowed to show the evidence?
So you couldn't bring up anything about COINTELPRO?
Oh, we weren't even allowed to use the words COINTELPRO. We weren't even allowed to use the words FBI past behavior.
What about the Arizona case?
The Arizona case was only allowed to be brought up in a limited way. The FBI had a sting operation against Earth First in 1989 when it manifested in 5 arrests. The FBI had a plan to blow up 3 nuclear power plants simultaneously. It was their plan. They tried to recruit people to do that. They found 1 Earth Firster and 2 nuclear activists who were willing to not engage in any explosive activity whatsoever, but they found 3 people naive enough to be willing to take down a power line in Arizona using a blowtorch, but not explosives. But when the people were arrested, including the founder of Earth First, who they arrested for donating a couple of $100 to the FBI undercover agent, that was the only thing he'd done, was taking a couple $100 from a bake sale. They announced that Earth First had a plan to blow up three nuclear power plants that the FBI thwarted, when in reality that was the FBI's sting operation and their idea that nobody actually bought into. We were not allowed to bring that up either, except in a very, very limited way. The FBI actually had arrested 7 Earth Firsters 6 months before the bombing in a tree spiking raid where nails were put into trees in the state of Montana, and all 7 of those people wound up being innocent as well after the headlines were made. And the way we know that they were innocent is the actual tree spiker was caught 3 years later, and he was not associated with the Earth First movement. So the FBI had an long-standing operation against Earth First.
Daryl Cherney, we're also joined by one of your attorneys, Bob Bloom, represented you and Judy Berry in the case against the FBI, the lawsuit that you won in court on Tuesday. You've worked, Bob Bloom, also on the Panther 21 case, as well as the cases of Geronimo Pratt and Daruba Bin-Wahad, among many others. Can you talk about what kind of precedent this case sets? I was sorry to see it's not in the Washington Post today, though the verdict came down early yesterday. It's on the inside pages of the New York Times. Someone just said to me that the last time the Washington Post did a piece outside of the obituary for Judy Berry in 1997 was a reprint of an AP piece just after the bombing, calling Judy Berry a terrorist. So they may owe her one, perhaps even a piece on this lawsuit.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
Well, they owe us a lot. they read it all to their job. They always do just what they've done now. The New York Times also, at the time of the incident, called Judy and Daryl bombers. Good morning, Daryl. And I had never heard from Judy's sister before, and I was blown away by what she had to say. She really spoke many of the words I had in mind talking about. What was the question again? Amy, what was the question?
I asked you about what kind of precedent this case sets.
Well, so far as I know, there was a long time ago in the 70s a recovery from a jury against the FBI for similar activity. This, to my knowledge, is the first finding of such magnitude. What's important, one of the things I find important about this finding by the jury, and we really do want to thank them, and we feel terrible that we really didn't get the opportunity to talk with them, but that was the judge's order, and we certainly respect that at the moment, is that they found much of the award of the $4.4 million total has to do with First Amendment violations. That is, a recognition by the jury that this really was not just about a bunch of cops on a given moment framing people, which is what they did, but that the reason for it was that they were trying to silence the activities of Daryl and Judy and all the people with Earth First and beyond. I think that's the significance of it as a precedent.
Can you talk about the FBI's defense and what they did with the jury?
Well, the FBI's defense was that, oh, it's not our fault. The Oakland police, they were in a big hurry to make the arrest. The Oakland police took the position, well, it's not our fault. The FBI was pushing us to make the arrest, and they were telling us so-called facts that we relied upon. Well, the FBI's defense was, well, we didn't really, mistakes were made. There was nothing intentional done here. In fact, as Daryl has already set forth to some extent, they told absolute lies that were demonstrated to be lies by the objective evidence, and evidence that you could see with the naked eye that the nails that they claimed were identical weren't even close to identical. The location of the bomb, they told, a lot of the trial was focused on, was the bomb under the seat where it was concealed, which was absolutely where it was, or, on the other hand, in the back floorboard where it would have been seen by Judy and Daryl. So they spent a lot of time trying to undermine demonstrable, clear facts in the case. There were other things as well, and it was a complicated fact situation. But the key is the jury saw right through it, and in their very thoughtful verdict, told the world, listen, this can't happen. And the significance, of course, and I'm sure you're going to ask about it, is what's happening today in Washington. They're trying to push the FBI with the kinds of powers, to have the kinds of powers that they had officially back before the 1970 Church Committee exposure of what the FBI did and has done for years. They're trying to do that again in the name of fighting terrorism. And it's really, to me, the bottom line is people don't let them do that. It's bad enough that the FBI does it without permission. Don't give them permission to get in your underwear or anybody else's underwear. That's what they want to do. They want to stop dissent. Just look what they're doing. Pay attention. Please don't let it happen.
Bob Bloom, I want to thank you for being with us. Daryl Cherney, congratulations. Earth First activist who just won his lawsuit along with the late Judy Berry against the FBI and the Oakland police. Before that, we heard Martha Berry, the younger sister of Judy Berry, speaking for the family. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll talk more about the FBI. Stay with us as we go out with one of musician and environmentalist Daryl Cherney's songs.
5 billion turns a day, 5 billion turns a day. We got to compost what we make the most, 5 billion turns a day. Now turds, they make good fertilizer, but we no longer deliver. Instead of putting it down in the dying ground, we flush it into the river. Myself with pride. Oh, 5 billion turds a day.
5 billion turds a day. Daryl Cherney, environmentalist and activist, and now victorious in a lawsuit against the FBI and the police. I'm Amy Goodman here on Democracy Now! As we look at the case of the U.S. citizen accused of plotting to explode a radioactive dirty bomb in the United States. His attorney filed a motion in federal court Tuesday challenging his indefinite military detention. Attorney Donna Newman says the Pentagon has not yet told her whether she'll be allowed to see her client, Abdullah al-Muhajir. She says he's been held, quote, on information from sources who are unknown, whose reliability is uncertain, whose credibility is uncertain. Al-Muhajir was arrested last month, but was transferred Sunday from a federal prison in Lower Manhattan to a high-security naval brig in South Carolina. According to the Washington Post, that transfer came less than 2 days before he was scheduled to appear before a civilian judge. No charges have been filed against him. Senior intelligence officials allege that al-Muhajir, whose name he was born, Jose Padilla, met in late March with senior al-Qaeda officials who sent him to scout possible U.S. sites for attacks. Officials say they were tipped off after interrogating al-Qaeda leader Abu Zubaydah, who was captured in Pakistan. But the London Independent is reporting British and European security officials are highly skeptical of the Bush administration's case. British sources point out no evidence has been produced to show that he had access to the radioactive material, that's al-Muhajir, that he had access to the material needed to build a bomb, or indeed that he even worked out a time or place to launch the attack. British security sources also say the Americans investigated Muhajir's activities and tried to find a terrorist network he may have been involved with inside the U.S. The highly publicized announcement of the arrest only came after the failure to find anything more incriminating. In Washington, there's growing suspicion the arrest was seized on by the Bush administration in dramatic fashion for political ends. Michael Ratner's our guest, international human rights lawyer and president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Michael.
Nice to see you, Amy.
Well, your first explanation, what you can understand about why Jose Padilla al-Muhajir was moved from civilian custody to military custody and now called an enemy combatant.
Well, it's hard to say what was in their mind. I know that from a legal perspective, it's particularly outrageous. We complained a lot when they started doing this to non-citizens, whether in Guantanamo or elsewhere, putting them in military custody even though they weren't picked up on a battlefield. And we always said, now they're going to do this to citizens. They're going to wind up putting them into military brigs, no court proceeding, essentially indefinite and arbitrary detention. And that's what they've done here. And what you have now is the Attorney General of the United States basically saying, I designate you, I'll put you in prison, I'll put you in a military brig forever with no chance of ever getting a court proceeding.
And what does that mean when you transfer from civilian to military? I mean, as some are saying, Donna Newman, the attorney for al-Muhajir, had just said he is at the end of the time he can be just held. You have to bring charges or release him. And that was the point. They didn't bring charges, but they switched him. And why, when you make that switch into military custody, do you not need the same kind of evidence?
Well, first of all, he was being held probably in a fashion that in the U.S. court, in the federal district court, in a way that one judge has ruled was illegal, which is on a material witness warrant pursuant to a grand jury appearance, which that has already been held illegal in our Southern District only a few weeks ago in another Muslim case. So what they did here, they didn't want him to go back in before a judge, first one that might hold the whole proceeding illegal for keeping him without any evidence on a material witness warrant. Secondly, at some point, they're going to have to charge the guy. How long can you keep a guy in jail in a civilian court without any charges against him? So they were nervous about that, obviously, for some reason. We don't know why. Some people said he wasn't cooperating, and they figured, well, let's put him in jail indefinitely. Maybe we'll get him to cooperate. Some people said they don't have enough evidence against him, so we can't bring any charges. Who knows what the reason is? It's probably one of those two. When they move him to military custody, well, that's an interesting question because they're really writing the rules now. If you're in military custody, there are rules. There's military law. You're either a prisoner of war, which we, of course, have denied that he is or any of the people in Guantanamo are, or if you're not, then you still have to have eventually charges brought against you, either through a court-martial or, in the United States' case, through their belief that they can try people through military tribunals. Now, of course, the military tribunal order only applies to non-citizens. So how are they going to apply it to him? So what he is he's in a box. He's basically in a legal limbo in terms of his legal status, but he's in a real jail and will be indefinitely, as far as we can tell. And when I say indefinitely, I mean 3 months, 6 months, 5 years, 20 years, until their so-called war on terrorism is over.
Donna Newman, his attorney, says she hasn't had any access to him.
Well, that's, I think if we looked at, she had access, obviously, when he was in the civil proceeding. They have taken the
easy access.
Right.
Said.
There is another person, of course, like him, Hamdi, who was in a brig in Virginia, a U.S. citizen who was sent up from Guantanamo. The lawyer has had no access to Hamdi yet. He went into a district court to get access to Hamdi. The district court said, yes, you can have access. The U.S. appealed and said, no access. He's in our custody, military custody, no access. So they are probably most likely going to try and deny her access again. He is going to be held incommunicado, in a prison, no access. The precedent, obviously, for all of your listeners, for everybody, is extremely dangerous. This is the Attorney General saying, this citizen I'm putting in jail now, who's he going to say next? With no ability for anybody to challenge it. I'm going to put this person in military custody. Well, nobody can do anything about it. This is probably, in terms of civil liberties and civil rights, the most serious moment we've had in many respects, and it will tell us something about the direction this country is going to take in the future.
Mm-hmm. Michael Ratner is our guest, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, as we talk about the case of Jose Padilla, who renamed himself Abdullah al-Muhajir. He became Muslim, now in prison. I think it's important for people to realize everything we read about him, dirty bomb plot, etc. now, only comes from one source, and that's the Attorney General's office and the Justice Department. There is no counterbalance because there's no access to him. So whatever information comes out cannot be challenged at this point.
Well, I think that's one of the reasons it's very important what you did with the Judy Berry case, because that case is really an illustration, a really graphic one, of how you cannot trust the government and how you cannot trust the FBI, and why we have courts and why we have checks on what the Attorney General and the FBI does. They don't always work, but they're at least something. And in this case, we don't have those checks. So everything we have is the FBI and the Attorney General saying, trust me, trust me, trust me. And we know, your listeners know, especially after that Judy Berry verdict, which was so important, you cannot trust them. And this guy is sitting in jail based on someone saying, trust me, with no court at all to decide.
Well, the person who they say has given the information is not someone the U.S. government trusts, al-Qaeda leader Abu Zubaydah, unless he has some connection to the U.S. government. I don't know.
Right.
But anyway, apparently they're saying he said that somehow al-Muhajir was involved with a bomb plot. Now, what if this were the case, that he was, that they have no evidence, though, that suggests this, except the statement of this man? What should be done in this case?
Well, then, of course, you would have put him in a civilian court, and they'd have to bring the witness forward, and he would have to be cross-examined, because that witness, for all we know, he could name 30 other names in the phone book. You know, the FBI does an interrogation. The FBI could say, well, maybe it's this guy, maybe it's this guy. They put names in the guy's mind. He names 30 people. Ashcroft then goes and picks up 30 more people. You could have this guy being used as a source of names, suggested names by the FBI, which they've done before with witnesses, and pick up anybody they want to, political opponents, anybody out there in a group that's opposed to the government that dissents from the U.S. policies in Afghanistan. So what has to happen is this guy has to be tested under cross-examination, the way you would try and get anybody else in jail.
So what is happening right now?
Well, what is happening
around his
right
case? How are people organizing around it?
Well, I think people are very, very upset, both around what it means for him, which is to say, is there any evidence with regard to him, but just as much for the rest of us, because this is really a push going from non-citizen to citizen. It's the old, first they came from the non-citizens, now they're coming for the citizens, and a guy like Ashcroft in power in this position to just point people out and get them arrested. So I think there is a lot of organizing going on. There's a lot of people objecting to it. There's certainly a lot of media attention to it, and I think there are a fair number of people even on the right wing of the spectrum that are worried about a situation when an executive official can simply designate people to put into a military prison and put them into a Kafkaesque hole. This is basically Devil's Island as far as this guy is concerned and as far as other citizens may be concerned who may be put there.
Well, Michael Ratner, I want to thank you for being with us. Michael Ratner of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Your website?
HumanRightsNow.org. And CCR has a website, the center has one, ccr-ny.org.
And you are listening to Democracy Now! As we move to our last segment. Front page article in today's Christian Science Monitor begins, "Just when Washington's political life seemed to be returning to normal, the war on terrorism has returned with a vengeance, reclaiming its position as the overwhelming concern of the nation's capital. For a time, Democrats had begun to focus again on issues they felt might turn to their advantage in the fall election, such as Social Security and the cost of prescription drugs. President Bush resumed doing what presidents do as off-year votes loom, make quick trips to the hinterland to raise cash, support candidates, and promote his education policies and other items on the domestic agenda. Then President Bush proposed the establishment of a new Department of Homeland Security, a mammoth undertaking which could preoccupy Congress for months. The administration announced the arrest of a man accused of plotting to explode a radioactive dirty bomb in America, reemphasizing the stakes in the continuing struggle against Al-Qaeda. Whatever the reasons for the timing of the White House moves, the Christian Science Monitor writes, one of their effects is a change in Washington's, indeed the nation's, political conversation, back to issues on which the administration is on solid ground with the public." That from the Christian Science Monitor. But as the Bush administration turns the national discussion again to homeland security and seeks ever higher amounts of money to fund the so-called war on terror and new multi-billion-dollar weapon systems, the man that ran his election campaign as the education president seems to be abandoning one of the most basic ways of ensuring a safe and secure country, a well-educated population. The current issue of Education Week is reporting school districts all over the country are struggling just to fill the gaps left by leaner state budgets. Last week, some 20,000 young people rallied outside New York City Hall to denounce Mayor Michael Bloomberg's proposed cuts in the city's school funding. Meanwhile, a standardized testing wave is sweeping the nation. Critics say politicians may be able to make test scores look good on paper, but standardized testing actually increases dropout rates and forces teachers to teach to the test rather than encouraging critical thinking. Last week, an ad hoc group of educational and free speech organizations revealed the New York State Education Department was using censored passages in exams, taking all references to race, ethnicity, and gender out. School privatization is also an issue. Edison Schools announced last week it will borrow $40 million to finance its takeover of 20 struggling public schools in Philadelphia. Edison's privatization of Philadelphia's public schools is the largest and most ambitious experiment in the history of school privatization. Today, we're going to have a roundtable discussion on issues affecting schools around the country. We're going to go to break, and then we'll be joined by Ann Cook, who is the co-chair of the New York Performance Standards Consortium, a coalition of 32 high schools across the state which use performance assessment instead of high-stakes testing. And then we'll have a discussion, a debate on the privatization of schools on the Edison schools. We're going to go, though, to a break with Richie Havens as he sings, "I Was Educated by Myself."
It all seems the same, such a silly game, played by silly fools who don't even know or follow their own rules. But oh, when the sunshine follows me around, lifts my feet, takes me from the ground, high enough me to tell that I was educated by myself. Oh,
oh. Richie Havens, I was educated by myself. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. This is Resistance Radio. And Cook is our first guest, co-chair of New York Performance Standards Consortium. It's test time. Kids around the country are in their pre-ulcerous conditions of studying and preparing for, well, what exactly? What are these tests testing?
Well, the tests in New York, the Regents test that's being given next week, are the 11th graders have to take these tests, or 12th graders if they've not passed them before, in order to graduate from high school. These are high-stakes tests. New York State now has four. We'll soon have five. We have an English Language Arts Regents, a Math Regents, a Global History, American History, and they've introduced these one at a time. And in order to graduate and get a diploma, you must take and pass these tests. That's, even if you've been to school every day, passed all your courses, you could conceivably take these tests, as some students have done, and not pass them because you don't know how to take the test, or you're a new person, a new English language learner. You might have passed all your courses, not passed this test. You will not get a high school diploma. So these are really high stakes tests.
What is your problem with them?
Well, first of all, I don't think that anybody, there's no organization in the country that supports the use of high-stakes tests, not the American Education Association, not the National Research Council, the National Council of Teachers of English. No organization in the country that is concerned with education believes that you should use a single instrument to determine whether a child graduates or is promoted. There are all sorts of ways of knowing if students know something. It puts an enormous amount of influence to the test. And as we've seen the last week, these tests are really highly suspect. Not only do they censor, they're also not constructed very well. They rely on, as we've seen, censored passages in the case of the English.
Can you talk about that? People around the country might not have heard what was going on in the United States, in New York with the Regents.
Well, what happened was that there's a group that I'm affiliated with, the New York Performance Standards Consortium. We're a group of schools that for seven years have used performance assessment. That means that students have to demonstrate that they can write a literary essay, that they can produce a research paper, that they can design and carry out and defend an original science experiment, that they can apply mathematical concepts, that they can actually do things rather than just take a pencil and paper test. It's been an extremely successful system. It was so successful that the previous Commissioner Sobel, granted this group of schools a waiver from the Regents and said you can give a Regents diploma if you use these assessments. It's also monitored by outside people. So we've had a problem with this one-size-fits-all test for quite some time. In the process of us looking at these tests, about a year and a half ago, one of our parents noticed that there was some very odd passages. They didn't read right. One of them, for example, called a speech by Anne Lamott. It called it a speech. It wasn't really a speech. It was a piece from Bird by Bird. And when we looked at it more closely, she discovered that, in fact, it had been censored. They had left out the word, the phrase, "she's gay." And it actually rendered the passage completely incomprehensible. And from there, we moved on to a passage by Isaac Bashevis Singer. They call in the test Isaac B. Singer. Very often, they don't even attribute. And that particular passage left out references to the fact that Singer was writing about his family in the ghetto in Eastern Europe, and that the family was Jewish, and that they were having a contact with a Gentile woman. All of that was taken out. And Jeannie Heifetz then began to look more systematically about 3 months ago. By this time, there were 10 of these tests that had appeared.
You also had what students coming across a speech by U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan in the standardized English test. They didn't see his remarks about the U.S. debts to the United Nations.
That's
or
correct.
Annie
mm-hmm.
Dillard's memoir, An American Childhood, gone any racial references from a description of her childhood trips to a library in a black section where she was one of the only white visitors.
Right. So there was a systematic censoring of out of 26 passages that we looked at. About 20 of them had been seriously censored. Now, there are two different problems with this. One has to do with the test, and that we're now giving kids on a test passages, asking them questions about literature, which really has they're not literature anymore because they've been so fundamentally changed. But one has to also understand that these tests, because they are so important, the tests themselves have become the curriculum. So they're all on the website. The state has a website. Teachers are using them to teach kids how to take the test. So now we not only have tests that are being using censored material, we're also you have curriculum that's now being censored. And so this a group of free speech organizations, the National Coalition Against Censorship, Penn, the American Center, the New York Civil Liberties Union, and our groups, which are a Parents Coalition Against High Stakes Testing and the New York Performance Standards Consortium, came together. And actually, the letter that went to Commissioner Mills requesting that this be stopped, this policy, was signed onto by my many, many organizations. Now, what I might say that I think the public thinks that this situation has been taken care of, because he said that he will now no longer use censored passages. But the problem with this policy is that there are guidelines called the sensitivity guidelines, which caused this problem in the first place, and the State Education Department uses those guidelines to determine whether something is offensive or not, or, as the Deputy Commissioner Roseanne DeFabio from the state said, makes a child uncomfortable. And what they have not said is that those sensitivity guidelines will be reviewed or withdrawn. So what will now happen is that instead of a passage being censored, being selected and then censored, now we'll have the ideas censored before the passages ever get to the test. So we will no longer not have, I don't think, passages that are written that discuss race or ethnicity or religion. Those passages will simply not be chosen. And that that will have the effect of determining curriculum, which will also censor out these materials. Because, again, because the tests are so important and they're high stakes, teachers will teach to the test, so they will not include those kinds of those pieces of literature.
The organization that you chair, the 32 high schools across the state which use performance assessment instead of high-stakes tests, are they going to go on not using high-stakes tests?
Well, we're trying very hard not to use these high-stakes tests. The problem is that the commissioner, having seen that these schools were incredibly successful, most of the schools have a population, is an aggregate of schools. We have a population that's more challenged than New York City. So we have more kids on free and reduced lunch. We have a greater number of English language learners in our schools. In fact, we have three schools in our consortium that only work with kids who have been in the country less than 4 years. And despite all of those issues, the kids that go to these schools have produced much better data than students attending comparable region schools. So, for example, we send 90% of our kids on to college. The city only sends 61%. Our dropout rate is way below what the city is. I mean, the city has a dropout rate somewhere that they admit to between 20 and 30%. Probably in some areas it's higher than that. So we believe that these tests, we've leveled the playing field for kids of color, for example, and sent many, many of them on to college where they know how to write papers and they know how to function in an academic environment. So we're desperately trying to hold on to this, and I think, it's part of trying to push back the high-stakes testing that has kind of gone through many of the states, and that Bush, in fact, built into his Leave No Child Behind. It should really be Leave No Child Untested policy.
We've been talking to Ann Cook, who is a co-chair of the organization that represents schools that don't engage in high-stakes testing. Not clear how much longer they can do that, but actually use performance assessment. And we're going to turn now to Philadelphia. The Edison Schools announced last week it'll borrow $40 million to finance its takeover of 20 struggling public schools in Philadelphia. Edison's privatization of the Philadelphia public school system is the largest and most ambitious experiment in the history of school privatization. We've got Adam Tucker on the line with us, who is a spokesperson for Edison Schools, and Ashley Smith, who is a high school student from the Philadelphia Student Union. She's 17 and attends Chester High in the suburbs of Philadelphia, which is run by Edison. First, Adam Tucker, can you talk about the Edison School takeover of these schools in Philadelphia?
Yes. First of all, thank you for inviting me onto your show. Philadelphia has been a troubled district for decades, unfortunately. Last summer, the governor and the mayor came to an agreement whereby they decided that they were going to look at some very serious ways to reform the district. They were facing two gruesome things. One is that the academic achievement, as measured by some of the tests that Anne was just discussing, that's how schools are measured, whether or not they're successful. The high-stakes test in Pennsylvania is called the PSSA. And students were scoring across the city at such low levels that, frankly, they could not figure out what other strategies to use. That, coupled with a huge financial crisis that was also in the district, meaning that they were running up a deficit of hundreds of millions of dollars over years, meant that both the mayor and the governor decided we need to do something dramatically different. One of the outcomes of their partnership, which was a long and complicated process, was to radically reform 70 schools, 70 elementary and middle schools. As part of those 70 schools, Edison has been asked to partner with community groups and run 20 of those schools. There are another 22 schools that will be privately managed by other education organizations, some universities, and some grassroots groups in Philadelphia. So our effort here is to work with our community partners to help, help improve 20 schools that have struggled for decades in Philadelphia. And right now we're beginning that process in terms of building relationships with folks in Philadelphia and coming up with a plan for improvement.
Ashley Smith, you're a student in one of the schools, which is being run by Edison, Chester High. What is your reaction to this very ambitious experiment in the history of school privatization?
First, I would like to say thank you for having me on the show. And, just by listening to what he was saying about Edison and how, you know, they're coming into Philadelphia and they're willing to work with the community partners and the community themselves. But last summer, if that was the case, then how come last summer no parents were asked about how they felt about things like that? And no, still to this day, parents have not been asked if that's what they want. And in the city of New York, they got to do a vote if they wanted privatization in there. And the parents voted, and privatization was not even brought up into New York. So my only question to you is, how come you haven't informed the parents about what's going on? How come you haven't tried to talk to parents? And you're right, this has been going on since last summer. And not many parents know about it because Edison is not trying to put forth the effort to let parents know.
Right. A couple of things. One of the things that's been very, I think, confusing about this whole process is that Edison has been probably the centerpiece of this entire debate in Philadelphia, which, frankly, from my perspective, from our perspective, is completely wrong. The centerpiece needs to be, how do we improve schools? So many of the headlines, so much of the discussion has been about Edison schools, our ups, our downs, and unfortunately, what that has meant is that some people, I think, have not been fully informed of the actual process. One of the things that's important here is that what's happening in Philadelphia is a state takeover of those of schools. The state has taken over the running of the district. They have done away with the existing school board and put in a new board that is a combination of people from the state as well as the city. Now, I mention all that because what that meant is that Edison Schools was never, and still to this day, is not in control of the process. And so our hands have been tied in many, many ways that I think people do not understand. For example, we were not allowed by the state and the city to contact parents. We were not allowed to contact teachers because negotiations were going on. You are absolutely right. We wanted to and are beginning to do that outreach. And because we were not allowed to do that, some of that work, I think it has made our efforts more difficult. But now that we're about finished with these negotiations and we're beginning to do some outreach, we're hoping that we can all get on the right track together, because schools will not be successful unless the community, parents and students alike are completely engaged in the process.
Ashley Smith, why are you against the Edison School takeover?
Because I'm against it because, one, they keep on saying Edison promises different things, which now that I'm in the Edison School, I can see is not true. What I mean when they say they promise things, they promise to give every student a computer to take home. I don't have one to take home.
And Ashley, one of the things I think, again, this is part of the difficulty when there's not enough communication, we actually don't give computers in the first year of running a school. It's only in the second year. So Chester High, as you know, this is the first year.
Mm-hmm.
And what grade are you in, Ashley?
I'm a junior.
Okay.
I think you also
know that part of Dr. Poteet, he's the principal, part of his plan was to begin at the ninth grade level making some transitions. So juniors and seniors, your program has not changed significantly since last year, if I understand things correctly. And that's on purpose. As I think many of us know, school reform is a difficult and important process. And at Edison, we are trying to go through it as thoughtfully as possible. Our strategy in Chester, for example, at the high school was, and this is some communication we got from parents and teachers and students, was to leave the junior and senior program relatively intact, that for kids who were planning on going off to college or to work, that they didn't want a significant change in their program. And so we focused our efforts on the ninth grade level and begin, and our plan is to grow the Edison program in that way.
Let me bring Ann Cook back into the discussion. Now, you're from the city that voted no to Edison, so they couldn't take over the schools here.
Well, I think the parents showed remarkable intelligence to vote no against the Edison schools coming into New York City. One of the things that's troubling to me is that the criteria, regardless of what the state is saying, the criteria for judging whether schools are successful in Edison, in the case of Edison, is always the test scores.
Yes,
and so this becomes the focal point for all of their efforts, and the curriculum gets completely trivialized because the test score is the most important thing. The other thing I want to say that I think is very disturbing about Edison is that I don't know of any of the Edison people who have pushed Edison, who have gone out and tried to get investors, who put their own children into these schools. And to me,
mm-hmm.
that is the bottom line. If you believe in something, I would put my children into my school.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that I would put them into any of the consortium schools. And I think that one of the things that's very troubling about the current reform effort is that there are a lot of people at the policy level and at the state political level dictating policy for other people's children. And I think that we have to really take that into account when we look at projects like Edison.
Last question, and this is to Adam Tucker. According to the district evaluation from the Chester Upland School District, it says that Edison's in danger of not meeting standards for improvements on attendance and suspension rates, truancy up, attendance down. That was in March. Your response?
Our response is that at any moment in time when you go through school reform, change is difficult. And you're absolutely correct. We have more suspensions this year. And one of the reasons we believe that to be the case is because we're actually doing some of the data keeping and reporting to the state that had not happened in Chester High before. And we're also enforcing the code of conduct that is agreed upon at the school in a way that it hasn't been enforced before.
But Mr. Tucker, one of the things about Edison is that it has said people from Edison have said this publicly.
5 seconds.
That you also want to go in with your baseline data as being the lowest possible reading score so that everything you do shows an improvement.
On that note, have to wrap up. Ann Cook, Adam Tucker, and Ashley Smith, thanks for being with us. That does it for today's program. You can get a copy if you call 1-800-735-0230. You can look at links to their websites at our website, democracynow.org, as we end with Neville Brothers Sitting in Limbo. Democracy Now! Produced by Chris Abrams, Miranda Kennedy, Lizzie Ratner, Michael Ye, Anthony Soliner, engineer and music maestro. Special thanks to Uri Galed and Karen Renucci, Simba Russo, Orlando Richard, Emily Kunstler, Anna Noguera, as well as Angela Alston, Michelle Guanca. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.